Welcome to the America's Jobs Team podcast. Every week, we dive deep with economic development professionals on leadership and other issues challenging our industry. Our goal is to equip listeners with the knowledge to grow their impact and influence. You are America's Jobs Team, and when you get stronger, communities thrive.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the America's Jobs Team. I'm Ron Kitchens, and I'm so pumped to have Ian Johnson with me. Ian's official title is Vice President of Economic Development of OmniTrack, but he's my railroad guy. So anytime I have a railroad question, it's Ian who gets called with it. And I think he's probably most everybody's railroad guy. But if you don't know Ian, well, I'll let him tell you who he is. Ian, what is your job really with OmniTrack?
Yeah, first off, thanks for having me on the podcast, Ron. I'm an avid listener, so I was just patiently awaiting my opportunity to be on. But my role with OmniTrack is kind of twofold. One, to lead our business development strategy and working with economic developers, site selectors, that marketplace or that ecosystem to try to get RailServe customers to locate on our 23 short lines throughout North America. Then the other thing is just working with those communities in which we have short lines to kind of embrace RailServe growth and prepare them for the rail opportunities to come to them. So think kind of getting communities to understand, hey, you have this great piece of property next to a main or next to one of our mainline tracks. Don't give it up to a data, right? It has a higher and better use. So just thinking through things like that with the communities that our rail lines run through.
I love that. You know, my belief that ignorance is the enemy, that goes to that, because a lot of times you don't know what the value of that asset is. And so you undervalue the asset, and then you can never get that back. If you sell that and you put a Walmart store in there when it could have been, you know, somebody that, you know, manufacturing that was going to deliver and take advantage of that sunk cost of a rail line. I love that. So what was your plan when you went to college?
That's a great question. So I actually didn't have much of a plan. So I was an economics major because it was the first time in my life that math made sense. I had a great high school economics teacher. I was terrible at math. She explained it in a way to where it made sense, primarily because it was about money. So it made a little bit of sense to me. So I was like, all right, I'll go major in this. So I get to my senior year of college and I'm scared crazy because I have no idea what I'm going to do with this degree because I don't want to be a stockbroker. And that's kind of the only thing I can think of to do with this. So I go to my advisor and I'm asking him, what can I do with this? And he's listing off things and none of them make sense or are things that I want to actually do. And then finally, he's like, well, what do you think about helping businesses make locational decisions? And that just seemed interesting to me. I didn't know much about it, but like, all right. So he's like, yeah, take this economic development course that we offer. And I took it and just got hooked from there.
So what college did you go to?
I went to Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio.
Awesome.
Yep.
So I just think it's interesting that they even had an economic development course.
Yep. It was taught by a guy who was doing a lot of study in kind of regional economics. And yep. So it clearly wasn't his core, but he taught you enough to be dangerous. And I was lucky in the sense that in addition to that, I was on student government there. And our advisor for that, his wife was the assistant city manager for the city of Dayton, who was over economic development. So he's like, hey, if you want to know more about this, I can maybe help you out. And so it just kind of snowballed from there.
That's awesome. I love that. So what's your career trajectory look like? What's your first job and how do you get to where you are today?
I did a few internships in college. And then when I graduated, I was kind of at this crossroads of, do I want to stay in economic development or do I want to stay in Ohio? Because at the time, this is 2000.
That's an easy question. Nobody wants to stay in Ohio.
As a no-finder, I'm sure it's an easy question for you. But it was 2007, so we're like on our way, if not in the recession and not know it at that point. So there weren't many jobs in local economic development available. I had to kind of put out some feelers across the country in economic development. I had a great interview with a gentleman in upstate New York in the southern tier, the county with Chemung, which is where Elmira is, kind of between Binghamton and Ithaca. And he's like, look, you can either go to grad school, or I can pay you with probably going to be a fairly lousy salary, but I promise you, you're going to work on deals and do a lot more than you'll ever learn in grad school. So I'm like, all right, this sounds kind of interesting. So went up to upstate New York, was an economic development specialist at a county EDC, a public-private partnership there. What was great was that it allowed me to get involved in a lot of deals quickly. There was a lot going on with the Marcellus Shale at that time. So this was kind of an epicenter for a lot of that. So it worked out really well in some of the things I got to work on. From there, one of the things I did was write a grant to the U.S. Economic Development Administration to get road, water, and sewer to an industrial park that we owned. And so I get a call from the regional manager out of the Philadelphia office. And he's like, hey, have you ever thought about coming to work for EDA? And I'm like, I didn't even know what EDA was before I wrote this grant. So no, I have not. And he's like, well, yeah, this is when the ARRA funding had come out. So it's like, yeah, like we're hiring a couple of positions. Come and think about it. So I apply in the Philly office, and then also saw the Chicago office had some openings, which the Chicago office covered Ohio. So I'm like, well, that would be kind of cool to be able to work in economic development in Ohio. So I apply in Chicago as well, get an offer for Chicago, move out there. And then I was charged with being the, they call them economic development representatives, but essentially that state's representative to find projects for EDA to fund. So I covered the state of Illinois doing that for about 3 years, worked again on a lot of road, water, sewer projects, some soft projects as well, some strategy things, some revolving loan fund type projects as well. And one of the projects I worked there was where the BNSF and Union Pacific Railroads crossed. There was a community, Rochelle, Illinois, that decided in the 70s to build its own kind of city-owned industrial park with its own city-owned rail line that had access to both of the major railroads. So in doing that project, kind of learned more about the railroad business. And then one of the guys at BNSF was like, hey, this job is opening up. It's through Jones Lang LaSalle, who has a contract with BNSF to kind of do some economic development work. Would you be interested? So again, knowing nothing about the rail industry, really, I decided I'll give it a try. So went to go do that for a while. That turned into me coming on full time at BNSF, which my role was, again, some of the same stuff I'm doing now, but for a Class One railroad, helping those communities embrace rail serve growth, working with our site selection and EDO partners to try to land rail serve customers onto our railroads versus our competitors. Did that out in the Southwest United States for about 5 years, then transitioned to the BNSF headquarters and did it for the Southeast United States. And then got a call about this opportunity with Omnitrax about a year ago, where the company wasn't getting much visibility at that time to a lot of the major economic development projects that were out there. I think at that time, kind of like Toyota, Mazda was running around, Tesla, like some of these big deals that take in a lot of rail cars. It was just, well, how do we get into those networks? How do you kind of engage with economic developers? How do you engage with site selection consultants? That type of stuff we really weren't doing in a cohesive way. So I came over to start doing that about a little over a year ago.
That's awesome. And you know, the thing that struck me as you said that is your willingness and openness to be available and to be present for mentoring, for people recognizing opportunity on your behalf, and then having the courage to step forward and that opportunity. You know, what, you know, the next question I've written down actually plays really well into that is, you know, talk about what the role mentors have played in your life. Because it's clear that a lot of people have seen things in you and touched you and said, hey, maybe you ought to look at this. Yep. Is that something you've thought about? And what makes you open to that? And why has it been so powerful in your life?
No, that's a great question. So what's interesting about my mentoring situation is that I've never been able to secure like a formal mentor. So I hear a lot of people, especially in economic development, talk about like one or two people that they had kind of this formal relationship with that really helped guide their career. And that's something, honestly, I'd like to change. So if there's anybody out there looking for a mentee, I definitely know a guy. But I have, however, been able to look at a long list of people from both kind of railroading and economic development as sort of mentors, with honestly you being one of them. So your thought of the biggest force for change being a job has become my professional mantra, and it keeps me doing this work and keeps me getting up in the morning to do this. So I pay a lot of attention to a group of people and how they move and how they do things, but I wouldn't go as far as to say those people have necessarily had a formal mentoring relationship. But then to just be open to change, I've been blessed and fortunate, right? To just have people who see something in me, even when I didn't see it in myself, to say, hey, like, you need to try this stretch assignment or try this new thing. I think it'll help at the very least for another tool in your economic development toolkit. And the way I kind of think about it is that I'm kind of just learning all this stuff for some job someday when I'm ready for it. I'll be able to go in. There's this community X. I don't know what it is yet. And it's like, oh, I know everything, or at least I know 75% of what I need to know to solve all your problems, because I've done all of these different things that you really need. And I'll be able to come in and just hopefully change that community one day.
It's a great answer. You know, and I've been, had that formal mentor and mentee relationship. I've been on both sides of that. And I'm not sure I think the formal stuff really works very well.
Really?
Because okay. I think this, so I'm mentoring somebody right now, and said, and they ask, and I said, okay, I'll have 7 meetings. After 7 meetings, we're both free to date other people. Because if it just goes on and on and on, it kind of starts to feel like you're having lunch with your grandpa. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's okay, but you don't get a lot out of it. You've heard all the stories. Yeah. So, you know, I think that having a time limit on it, but, you know, I'm right now very committed to this idea that I want a mentor who's a generation older, but more importantly, I want a mentor who's a generation younger. Mm. That, you know, when I see leaders right now are ineffective, it's because they got psychologically old and because they quit hanging out with people who are younger, who, whether it's a culture, you know, a modern pop culture, or understanding, you know, technology or understanding social change. If you don't have somebody younger than you mentoring you on that, then the only thing you can do is get older and less relevant. Because there's a lot of things you just can't teach yourself.
Yep.
And so I think it's critical of senior leaders. If you don't have somebody you're learning from in a fairly formal way, that they have the power and know it's okay to tell you, you know, you really can't say that anymore. Or, you know, we don't use those words anymore because here's what you think it means. But the meaning of that word changed, and you can't say that anymore. And unless you have that and somebody's open and willing to do that, then I think you quit being relevant. And none of us, nobody wants to be irrelevant. Even if you're into your career, you don't want to be irrelevant.
Nope, very true.
So I love that. You know, I mentioned social change, and we're in a time of incredible anxiety around the need for change, whether it's affordable housing, whether it's the systematic oppression or diminishing of people of color. You know, the guilt or pushback of that, of saying, I didn't do it, so why are you blaming me? And all this anxiety that goes along with this stuff, poverty issues, where we've seen, you know, lots of people thrive, but a significant number of people get left behind. I think we're going to even see more upheaval because it's clear that, you know, COVID has accelerated change, and a lot of jobs that existed in January are not going to exist next January.
Very true. And
so from your perspective, what's the role of economic developers as part of this change? How do we have those conversations? Because what I find is people now are so fearful, anxious, that they don't even know how to have good conversations.
Yep.
They don't know what words to use and vocabulary. And, oh, you can say that, but I can't say that. And, well, I never did that. Why should I go fix that thing? I just think there's so much out there. I'm looking for better angels. What are your thoughts on where we're at and what our role as economic developers are to get through it?
Yeah, so I think the days of a pure focus on jobs created and private investment induced into a service area or a community, I mean, those are gone the way of the smokestack chaser, right, for a local economic developer. I hate to go to another Ronism, as I'll call it, but I definitely believe it to be true. And it's the fact that the economic development organization is often seen as the entity that can get everyone in the room and get them talking. Right. So oftentimes in a community, there is no other entity that has the broad support of the community and all of its stakeholders. So like they say, to whom much is given, much is expected. And it becomes the responsibility of the practitioner and of the EDO to get involved in things like early childhood education and homelessness, workforce development, environmental issues, criminal justice reform, all of these things that historically the EDO didn't directly get involved with, one, selfishly to make your community as attractive and competitive as possible, but two, just as a community leader, that's your duty and that's part of what you give when you sign up for one of these roles.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. The I've been thinking about this a lot, like, because I love economic developers. I have been a beneficiary of the work of men and women creating jobs and took my family out of poverty. And so I think a lot about the men and women doing this work. And you know, one of the things I'm trying to figure out is, are there employment standards that we can set and say economic developers should have these kind of terms in their contract so that they can be honest superheroes? You know, if you're worried about, hey, if I go in and say that, you know, Senator Scott from North Carolina or South Carolina writes in one of his books about after he became senator, I don't know, I think it was a Mercedes he was driving, but, he was pulled over like 21 times in 6 weeks in his home district. And it was clearly he was driving too nice of a car while being black. Mm-hmm. He's a great guy. The senator is one of the really amazing men in our country. And so when I hear him say that, I go, oh, that really is my problem then. Because if I want to increase the workforce, if I want to increase the quality of our community, if fairness matters, then I got to go work on those things.
Yep.
But if you're not me and don't have good sense and, you know, worried about getting fired, you need some protections in your contract so you can go work on this. And I've been thinking about how maybe at IEDC level or something, we can take this on as a national kind of best practices reform to say we want to take care of our people so they really can lead beyond just the sexy stuff of groundbreakings and shovels and, you know, throwing great annual events. Because it does have, I mean, how do you, in a time where we had Chimura Economics give us some great data this week of our state and the Midwest, and it is clear that if we don't figure out how to get more young people to stay here and thrive, that the graying of the workforce will be so dramatic in the next 20 years that the quality of life will not exist. So if you understand that, then making sure that all people are valid, all people have opportunities to live the American dream as they define that American dream, that you're not known for the rest of your life for the worst thing you ever did. And I think in criminal justice reform, we, you know, took this strategy of we're going to, you know, lock people up and throw away the key. Well, guess what? There's a lot of good men and women who could come back into the workforce and help our communities thrive. Why would we want to deprive them and ourselves? I mean, that's like shooting yourself in the head.
Yep.
So, I think, and most economic developers that we know would agree with all those statements. but most of them don't have permission based on their employment to do that. So I think we've got to figure out a way to create either a individual voice with them in Safety Net or a national voice on these specific issues that they can then translate into local. But I don't think there's a lot of places that deserve to grow, but if they don't change the next generation, you know, your kids aren't going to pick those places to live if they don't feel safe and embraced and their version of the American dream isn't supported. And it's, and that's different than when I was a kid, and it's different than a generation before. So I do believe that economic developers are the hope of America, but we got to figure out a way to protect them so they can really have a voice.
Yep. You know, I agree.
You know, in college, and I serve on the board of a university, you know, we have tenured professors and they can go say and do what they need to say and do to advance that. Sometimes I vehemently disagree with them, but I 100% support their right to do that, because we won't advance unless we have that.
Mm-hmm.
When you look back at your career thus far, and they've got a long way ahead of you, but when you look back thus far, what's the thing you're most proud of professionally?
I think what I'm most proud of, Ron, is going back to that idea of, you know, the biggest force for change being a job, is to know there are projects out there that I've had a part in that have led to someone or multiple someone's being able to put food on the table. So similar to you, like I've been a beneficiary of a lot of the programs and initiatives that economic developers have worked on. So to be on the opposite side of that and be someone working towards that, and I will never meet that person or those persons in my life probably, but to know they're able to work because we located a customer or a prospect in location X and we bring grain to that facility. So now Kellogg can make cereal. And as a result, this person has a job. Just things like that, right, is what I'm most proud of, honestly.
See, I love that, that it's that you got to be part of the solution. And I think that's the funny thing. When I ask that question to economic developers, almost nobody pounds their chests. Everyone says, I got to be part of a team, yep, of a chain of leaders that did great things. And so there's some of the most collaborative, team-driven people I've ever met are in this business.
Well, the flip side of that, though, is that we're so team-oriented that sometimes it comes across almost too humble. And I know, as we've talked about before, at times it feels like there's a war against the economic developer. And yep. So you need to be able to tell your story, because if, you know, to someone who's not in our ecosystem or in our marketplace, you just read the paper and it shows is mayor whoever or governor whoever brought such and such company here. So economic development kind of works in this vacuum a little bit, right? And so if we're such team players that we can't effectively tell our story, it becomes hard for the public to understand what we do and then the need for us. And then that's where you go to finding the retired banker or the old newspaper editor becomes your economic developer. And no offense to bankers or newspapermen, but this is a profession that has a specific set of skills behind it.
No, I love that you said that, because that's, as you know, that's one of my passions. It's why we started the Top 50 America's Jobs Team, Top 50 Economic Developers, because we were seeing amazing people not be recognized for being amazing. But if a third party, if somebody from outside recognized them, all of a sudden it was on the front page of their newspaper.
Yep.
And I knew that two things that resonate with me off of that are, we had a mutual friend of ours sits on the IEDC board with us, whose CEO of the organization had left. They announced they were going to do a big national search. This person was then named a week later to America's Top 50. And then the board immediately met, canceled the search, and said, if we already have one of the best economic developers in the country, why are we doing a search and hiring? And they were 100% right. Person is amazing, has been amazing, but it took somebody from the outside. Yep. And then last year, I had a lady who I'd never met before, who was nominated. We have a nomination process, and they're evaluators. And I wasn't part of it at all. I'm normally not part of it. And she called me to thank me because my name is in the press release. And she's crying and said, you know, was there an issue? And she said, no, I've been trying to get a pay raise for 13 years. Wow. Every economic developer around me makes double what I make. They all get raises every year. And because of you, they brought my salary up to be the second highest paid in the region because I made this list.
Wow.
And those things are life-changing. And we have to remember that. The work we do to support other economic developers, to support who we are. You know, one of the crazy ideas I have is that someday when I have more influence or more time, is to start a effort. So I have a friend who runs a group called the Charity Defense Fund, and all they do is step in and defend charities when they're criticized inappropriately. So for instance, Wounded Warriors is criticized for spending too much money on things that aren't directly to the soldier. Well, they were criticizing him for buying companion animals. Well, you know what? If you're missing a leg or you're blind, that seeing eye dog or that helper is pretty important. Yep. And so it wasn't until Charity Defense Fund stepped up and went to the media and said, no, here's the real story, that story came out. And so I think economic developers need a third party that's telling the story, that's supporting that, talking about the hard work. Because it is, I mean, we have a deal that we were talking about earlier that we're tonight in our final public meeting on, and it was 5 years' work. My team worked on that deal for 5 years. It's an $800 million investment. Those things take time, but it took 5 years. But, you know, we won't be in the picture when the shovels are turned.
Exactly. And
so I think we do have to have that process of reminding people, particularly in a time where we all got to raise more money from either governmental or private sources. If you're not telling your story, you know, Ewing Kaufman, who is the founder and owner of the Kansas City Royals, I had a brief encounter with as a kid. And one of the things he left me with is that you're not telling your story, if you're not blowing your own horn, nobody will ever hear the music. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, one of those things we don't do well in our industry. You know, 2020 has been nuts. COVID's been crazy. We've all been working remotely. You both lead remotely and are on a team being led remotely. What's the biggest leadership lessons you've learned about yourself and your leadership and during this COVID era?
Yeah, like you said, my team is remote. So COVID didn't hit our stride as bad because we were already dealing with working remotely. One thing I've tried to do, and it's worked out pretty well, is just over-communicate. So we have a regular huddle amongst our team to make sure we're on the same page as far as priorities go. And then everyone gives their big three priorities and then also send out what they need help with. I would recommend anyone that's struggling to keep their team engaged, strongly recommend over-communication. Don't assume the team has heard something or saw an email. You got to actually discuss it. Then you got to get feedback on that to make sure they understand it correctly. You understand any concerns they have. And then you both agree on a path forward, or at least both understand the path forward. And that's really been the big thing for me, is just, again, that over communication has been important, Ron. I before would have said I was the leader who would try to communicate mostly through email. Honestly, just kind of, hey, it's easy, it's fast, I can do it at any time, send out a lot of emails and then reply to it back. But COVID made me realize, okay, we need to sit down daily. We need to get on the phone or we need to get in front of each other on Zoom, but we need to understand, one, again, like you mentioned earlier, we're in trying times from not only kind of a racial, socioeconomic perspective, a economic perspective in itself, but then also this pandemic on you. So you got to check on people, right? You just got to make sure, hey, are you okay? First off, is your family okay? And okay doesn't just mean you don't have COVID, right? Like there's a lot more to that. But then also, yeah, like we need to communicate and see each other. Most people in our business, as you can attest to, are type A people. They like to be around people, like to kind of interact. So you got to make sure we're still having that communication and still seeing each other regularly. And again, that over communication is what's really helped my team.
Yeah, no, I think you're dead right. And I don't think the new way of communicating ever goes away again. I think this idea that, you know, COVID didn't really change much, but it has accelerated the change dramatically. And this idea of, you know, we use Slack and we use email, and that it wasn't enough. It was face-to-face meetings, and it is a phone call just to check in and say, hey, I heard you weren't feeling well today, or hey, I saw on social media that your mom's not well. Tell me about what's going on with you. The human capacity, the humanity of our work as leaders, I think is the most critical thing. The work, great people will get the work done, but they've got to do it. They will only do it for a leader and for a group that truly embraces caring about them. And that isn't their productivity, that's their humanity and their soul. And if you can't embrace that, I don't know how you sustain in the future.
Yeah, I try when we do our team huddle, the first 5 minutes, we're not talking work at all. Just tell me how you're doing. We're talking about what you did this weekend, what your kids are up to. Again, to provide that human aspect to this, because I'm more interested in my team as those individuals and those people versus the work getting done. And like you said, the work will get done when the individual on the team feels like they're a part of a team and they're a part of something that cares about them.
Yep. No, that's it. And we believe in the daily huddle as well. We call it a scrum, but this idea of if you hired the right team, their emotional and professional success is tied to their relationship with other people on the team. So if you take that away, the sense of loss is going to affect their productivity. So the most productive thing you can do is say, don't go be productive, come into and be in community.
Yep.
And take that 15 minutes, do it right, and then, you know, watch everybody just skyrocket.
Yep.
So, man, it's been so great to be with you. You know, this has been fun, but I know you have to get back to work. and Faye's giving me the eye, so it must be time. So, Ian, thanks for being with us. Thanks for being my friend. And I look forward to virtually seeing you soon.
Yeah, definitely. Same here. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, everyone. I'm here today with Steve Jast, who is the president and founder of Research on Investment and Gazelle AI. Hey, Steve, it's great to speak with you today. As one of the leading voices in investment attraction and lead generation, what has stuck out the most for you over the past few months?
Hi, Faye. Thanks so much for the question. First and foremost, let me say that I love the content that Consultant Connect has been generating. I'd also like to take a second to wish all of our listeners continued good health. Every day is really a new adventure. We're seeing some sad stories of industries and companies in steep, unexpected decline, and we're also seeing areas of growth and opportunity. A couple of areas that have generated significant strategic discussions center around supply chain and reshoring. To help economic developers blend these into their strategic plans moving forward, we've been providing complementary data pools and access to our Gazelle AI platform.
That's really awesome, Steve. I'm sure this data has helped many economic development organizations. Can you explain how exactly Gazelle AI helps?
Sure. Yeah, great question, Faye. Our platform includes supply chain data for over 900 industries with related company listings. We also have complete company hierarchies, meaning users can build lists of companies that have an HQ in a specific state or country with manufacturing activities in other specific countries. This is ideal for economic recovery planning, reshoring business attraction strategies, understanding local supply chains, and overall investment attraction.
Wow, thanks, Steve. Hey, everyone, if you would like to activate your complimentary access to Gazelle AI, connect with Steve by emailing him at Steve, S-T-E-V-E, at gazelle.ai. That's Steve at gazelle.ai. Thanks for joining us for today's episode. Tune in again next week for more insight and relevant content to the issues impacting economic development today. America's Jobs Team podcast is sponsored by Research on Investment and Gazelle AI.